Time for action. Climate scientists warn big changes have to be made to limit global warming. But will politicians listen? And what's the fallout if they don't? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the programme. I'm Rob Matheson. Now, for more than a century, industrialisation has spread across much of the world and we've been squeezing the life out of our natural resources. The planet is getting warmer and the places on it where humanity can live healthily are getting fewer. The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, commonly known as the IPCC, has brought together scientists from 195 countries to solve the problem. In the last 8 months, it's published two reports looking at the causes and the effects of climate change. Its third one has just been released, suggesting what we can do to reverse the damage. It says limiting global warming to a target of 1.5 degrees Celsius is beyond reach unless big changes are made. They say fossil fuels have to be reduced and alternatives have to be developed. Cities have to be smaller and more walkable. Industry has to change production methods. Planting more trees and developing low-emission agriculture systems would help to pull carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But switching to many of these systems can be costly. Governments will be tough to persuade, even though the world has the cash to pay for the changes. Wealthy countries are largely responsible for much of the damage caused by climate change, but it's often developing nations that are affected the most. The food charity Oxfam says there's a risk of unthinkable famine in East Africa. It says up to 28 million people in that region will face extreme hunger if the rains don't come again this year. 21 million people are already going hungry because of conflict, flooding and a widespread two-year drought. And more than 13 million across Somalia, Kenya and Ethiopia have been forced to leave their homes looking for water and farmland. OK, let's bring in our guests. In Guildford, in the UK, we've got Andy Reisinger. He's a member of the Bureau of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's also vice chair of Working Group 3. He was partly responsible for producing the substance of this report. In Dhaka, in Bangladesh, we have Sayeda Reswana Hassan. She's chief executive of the Bangladesh Environmental Lawyers Association. And she's also a Goldman Environmental Prize winner. And in Brussels, Stefan Zinger is joining us, a senior climate science and global energy policy advisor in the Climate Action Network International. Very good afternoon to you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Andy, let me start with you. Given the fact that you were partly responsible for the production and the content of this report, we have had similar reports in the past. What is significant about this one?
Probably two things. One is it is clear that we're not on track to limit warming to 1.5 degrees and time is running out if we want to keep that goal within reach. But there's also now clear evidence of really positive progress, which hasn't been enough to turn the curve yet. But we've for example, there have been massive falls in the costs of some key renewable energy resources, which means they're now cost competitive with fossil fuels in many areas. We've seen a spread of climate policies. More than half of global greenhouse gas emissions are at least in principle covered by climate laws. And these are vital tools that we can use to accelerate action to the extent needed that we actually want to limit warming to 1.5 degrees.
The headline from the, at least from the short analysis that I have of it here, says we can halve emissions by 2030. That is a very confident statement given what we have been hearing over the last few years. Is this dependent on a whole variety of different elements coming together in order to make this work?
The options differ across the different sectors, but yes, in aggregate, at costs of up to about $100 per ton of CO2 equivalent avoided, we could reduce global emissions to about half of the current levels within the next 10 years. But the way you achieve it in different sectors look very different. So in the energy sector, it's largely transitioning from the use of fossil fuels towards renewable energy or increased use of alternative low carbon fuels. Whereas in transport, it's much more about electrification, or in agriculture, it's about protecting natural ecosystems and increasing the efficiency of agricultural production systems. So we need less land to feed the global demand for nutrition. Mm. So the entry points differ from sector to sector, but collectively we have a wide range of tools available.
Stefan Singer, I know you've just had a very short time to have a look at the headlines of the report, but is there anything in the report which, with all credit to Andy and his team, that we couldn't have guessed already?
Well, I think we need to put this in a political context here. Although the IPCC is not policy prescriptive, it's supposed to be policy relevant. In the end, it will be policy prescriptive, whether we like it or not, because it shows very clearly, and we congratulate the IPCC for that one, that they show that technologies like solar and wind, like halting deforestation in tropical forests, like changing our diets towards less meat-based food, and energy efficiency will exactly do that, what Andy has said, help us to give us the opportunity to reduce our emissions by about half in 2030 in this decade, which is necessary to have a survival target of 1.5C global warming, which in itself will not be a paradise, which also will require lots of adaptation, but this was not the issue here. But that is a minimum, I think, what we need to have a livable planet, to protect ecosystems, to protect vulnerable communities, and to protect poor people from the catastrophic impacts from climate change, from sea level rise, from storms and horizons. So in that context, that report has provided some new things. And that's very, very important for policymakers, for the business and the finance industry. Second thing, I think it's very important to realize that the report has said that we need to scale up financing in all countries for all sectors by factor six, roughly, to have the chance to meeting that challenge. That requires significant mobilization of finances, of money, but also of policy, of legislation, and changes in legislation in countries to make sure that only resilient, climate resilient, and clean energy technologies and clean technologies which help the poor, which help the forests, are being promoted and are being encouraged. I think that's very, very important, and that brought the report out. I also have to say, last point here, that for us as Climate Action Network International, representing 1,500 NGOs worldwide, the report is not perfect. We have many things in there we do not like. There are many things we are falling through the grid. But that's a way. If you have a governmentally negotiated text, which is not purely based on the oruses, that's the way it is. And we know that. That has happened in the past. But overall, it's still a very valid wake-up call to the policymakers, the powerful and the impactful of this world, to change course throughout the world to avoid disastrous climate change.
Sayeda, all of this, I'm sure, are statements that, given your position in the Bangladeshi and Environmental Lawyers Association, you would agree with. But it's all very well saying to countries, you must change your industries, you must change your agriculture and so on. If you come to a country like Bangladesh, where its economy can be tumultuous at times, where it can be under strain, when it comes to, for example, the suggestion that everybody should wean themselves off fossil fuels, that's not something that Bangladesh can be willing to do very easily simply because of the structure.
I don't think Bangladesh should be reluctant in moving towards a 100% renewable energy policy. If a country like Rwanda can commit itself to a 100% renewable pathway, why can't Bangladesh do it? And also, Bangladesh, as a member of the most vulnerable countries forum, it in fact committed that by 2050 it will move to 100% renewables. And as the first speaker just said, that it has already been proven that renewable can be much less expensive than the fossil fuel. And Bangladesh has the worst air in the world. A global report has just come out that our air is the worst in the world. So Bangladesh also has an authority on renewable energy. It should be smart enough. It should have the vision to really work on the commitment that it has made in the international community. But for a country like Bangladesh, it's important also for us to remember that most of the fossil fuel projects that we are doing in our part of the world are being funded by the developed world. So the funding for fossil fuel must stop immediately across the world. Once they are pushed to that situation, then only the political governments will think about switching to renewable. Otherwise, the fossil fuel is not only attractive because it's being funded by the foreign countries. There is huge deal of corruption in most of the fossil fuel projects that are being sponsored throughout the world. So Bangladesh government would always argue about not having enough land, but there are models that are being shown, that are being practiced elsewhere, where you can actually have your cultivation in one patch of land. At the same time, you can have solar panels. And the Western world must come forward and support us with technologies where we can have renewable projects with less land requirement.
Have you seen any indication over the last few years, as this problem has become more obvious, that there is a change in attitude of those funding these projects? Is there a change within Bangladesh? I don't want to single out Bangladesh, but just as an example, is there an indication that Bangladesh is changing its way and actually doing something practical about this if the funding model changes as well?
With the change in the funding model, the government of Bangladesh has already abandoned 10 of its planned coal-based power plants. We are trying to, you know, impress upon other governments like the Japanese government so that it withdraws from the coal-based power plants it's planning to support in Bangladesh. We have seen some success that one phase of the Rampal coal-based power plant, which is just beside a World Heritage Site, has been abandoned because the government could not manage fund. Yes, there are governments who are saying that they will not be funding new fossil fuel plants here in Bangladesh, but for the part of the Bangladesh government, it's switching from coal to LNG. It's not making smart commitment, practical commitment. It's not drawing up action plan to deliver against its own commitment made in the international forum to go 100% renewable. It's also not doing enough to deliver against its own commitment to go 10% renewable, which was set for 2020. Now it's saying it's rising its target. The agency that we have has already said that we can switch to 40% renewable by just converting all the rooftops into solar panels. But the government is just not working with the right set of mind. Mm.
Andy, I had a very brief look at the report itself, and it is an extremely long and very, very detailed report. But if I, please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but section B2 of the report seemed to suggest that reductions in greenhouse gas fuels from fossil fuels and industrial processes had been less than emissions increases from rising global activity levels in industry, energy supply, transport and agriculture and buildings. Now, I took that to mean that basically whatever savings we're making in trying to reduce the amount of CO2 there is in the atmosphere is actually being outstripped by the level of industrialization and expansion in terms of construction and agriculture and so on. How do you redress that balance?
But by going harder on, I mean, what we've seen in the past is a slight reduction in the amount of carbon dioxide emissions per unit of energy that we're consuming. We can reduce that much faster by far more rapidly switching towards renewable energy systems, for example. So that would simply reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that we release into the atmosphere for every unit of energy we consume. If at the same time, we manage to increase energy efficiency, which most countries are doing over time already anyway. But if we can accelerate that further, we can achieve much faster reductions. But over the last 10 years, those small gains we've had from energy efficiency and a slight reduction in what's called the carbon intensity of energy supply, so that's the amount of carbon we emit for kilowatt of energy we produce, that simply has been outstripped by the increasing global come from both consumption and just increased activity in economies around the world. But there's multiple levers that we can apply. And one of the issues, I think, is that for many governments, there's historically been a single entry point to climate policy. Let's focus on just the power supply. Let's focus just on agriculture. Let's focus on pricing, but not on other things. And one thing the report tries to bring out is that a coordination of policies, both of climate policies with each other, but also greater synergies between broader development policies can open up the option space. And examples are, if you reduce fossil fuel use, then you typically, in Bangladesh, for example, would get large co-benefits for human health, with benefits with those benefits actually measurable in monetary terms to the extent that they would actually make it worthwhile. But it's a question of coordination between health departments and energy departments to actually allow governments to realize those benefits and then move more confidently in that direction. So that is exactly where we're shifting development into a space that allows a greater flexibility to apply climate policy can be really important. And that's one of the key themes that comes out of our report.
Stefan, it seems a lot of this, from what Andy is saying, centres around a tremendous amount of goodwill and a tremendous amount of coordination between governments around the world and individual departments, as Andy was saying, health departments around the world, which in the past has not exactly been the template. I mean, we saw to some degree the level of fractured connection there is between different countries when COVID broke. Is there any way of actually fixing that and fixing it quickly? Because if I understand what Andy's saying correctly, that level of communication, that level of interactivity is absolutely key to all of this.
That's right. And as you mentioned, the COVID pandemic, unfortunately, we have seen there was an apartheid. The rich countries, the wealthy countries, which had the money to develop the vaccines, have stored, kept the vaccines for themselves and give only a little bit to developing countries. That was not a good example. And I think we need to learn from that one. And I think we all, and I'm coming from a rich country, from Belgium, being a German, we need to embed in policymaking, independent of climate change, right, for all issues regarding sustainable development. We also have the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, which are also very important, to bring in the idea and to fight really for the idea, for global solidarity, for overcoming inequality between nations, but also within nations. I think that's where...
Forgive me, Stefan. I wanted to come on to Saida because of the point there that came out in the report, which was the future planning of cities, which cities had to be, and I'm summarizing here, but essentially they had to be smaller, more easily walkable. And of course, that makes perfect sense, unless you're talking about a city like Dhaka, for example, or many of the other cities that we could name that have high pollution rates and so on. Saida, what do you think would be a way of adapting a city like yours to be able to integrate at least some elements that are contained within this report so that places like Dhaka, places like New Delhi, for example, don't, for want of a better phrase, offset the benefits of any newer other cities that have been planned in different ways around the world?
See... first thing is we all want to be like Las Vegas. And then we forget our own culture. We forget our own way of lifestyle. So the development paradigm has to shift. We must not be following the extremely exploitative and irresponsible lifestyle of the Western countries. That is what has led to this problem of climate change. I think it's very important that the problem of urbanization is irreversible. Once you develop an urban area, you just destroy the entire thing once and for all. You can't just go back and, go back to the natural state of the area. For a city like Dhaka, it is important to understand that we don't want to be Singapore, we want to be Dhaka. And for a city like Delhi, that is also something that they have to realize. Second is transportation. Dhaka, everyone here, most of the middle class, upper middle class, rich people, we all have a car because that is the symbol of status. And that is what the Western lifestyle has taught us to have. But it has, at end of the day, become a completely car-locked city. Cars just don't move. So we have to switch to smart public transportation. That will ease the burden on burning of fossil fuel. It will also ease the pressure on the city roads. And all of us in Dhaka, if we have to do our offices in person, we lose 3 to 4 hours every day on the road. So it has to be a comprehensive planning. There's no greenery in Dhaka. All the urban forestry is gone. We had beautiful lawns in front of our houses. Now all our forest, all our lawns, all our gardening has switched to our rooftop.
Sayeda, forgive me, I'm going to interrupt you there because if what you're saying is prompting a response from our two other guests. Stefan, let me go to you first, then I want to come to Andy for his response. Stefan, you right at the start, you had a point to make there.
Yeah, I can fully support with my colleague from Bangladesh that public transport is one, but not the only key fundamental for making cities more livable. That's one point. But I would like to go a little bit broader, as I said before, and I started on equality. I think we would need to understand where do we need to reduce emissions primarily. I'm saying everyone needs to do its bit, right? But I think we need to understand that rich countries, rich populations in particular, and the IPCC has also told us that about 10% of the populations worldwide, and this is the rich people, are responsible for about almost half of the global emissions. And that's an issue we need to address in all countries. The rich people have to pay for that one. And they have to make sure, and we have to make sure that this is being addressed, because it's an issue of national inequality, but also international inequality is very important. Poor countries are not the sources of the pollution we have been facing, and they will not be the sources of pollution we are facing. Of course, they have to contribute as appropriate to what we want, but you cannot compare a per capita emission citizen of the US with someone who lives in Bangladesh.
Andy, I want
to... Someone who lives in Papua...
Stefan.
No, but let me finish
that
one, please. Let me finish that one, please. And I think that's where equity comes in, where we as the North have the fundamental duty, moral duty, principal duty, because it's also in our interests to help developing countries to adapt to climate change and to mitigate climate change, to give them and to help them with resources, with technologies, with investments. Right, it's not only in our own countries. We need to help them as well, because we also have contributed to the mess in the past. If you look at historical emissions, which are very well displayed in the SPM, in Figure 2, I'm talking about not technology. I'm talking about this details here. But you look at the SPM and you see this. The historic emissions of the rich countries.
Stefan, forgive me, I am going to interrupt you because unfortunately time is kind of coming up against us. But Andy, let me come back to you because you had a point to make. We have maybe a minute or so left on the show. If I can ask you just to be reasonably brief.
I just wanted to pick up on a point that Sayeda made about city infrastructure is a really good example. One key innovation in the IPCC report is that we take a dedicated look at ways of shifting behaviors and how to meet service demands without increasing emissions. And so providing infrastructure that enables people to take their own behavioral choices. I used to live in Delhi. I used to ride a bicycle there, and you take your life in your own hands. Making sure that city growth provides the choices for people to lead more sustainable lifestyles. That's greenery, that's urban gardens, that's public transport, that's individual no-car transport. These are design choices that are being made every day as cities continue to grow. It's not a once-off thing.
Andy, we're going to have to leave it there because unfortunately time is against us. Andy Reisinger, thank you very much indeed. I want to thank all our guests, Andy Reisinger, Sayeda Rizwan Hassan, and Stefan Singer. Thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Rob Matheson, and the entire team here in Doha, goodbye for now.